Style versus substance. How does a presidential candidate's speaking style affect our perception of his or her abilities? Good morning, live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Karen Fagans, in today for Melissa Ross. Just ahead, we'll talk with a speaking coach about what we can learn from the way the candidates speak. You can join the conversation this morning at 549-2937. Politics aside, which candidate do you think is most effective on the stump and why? Also this morning, a frightening trend on the First Coast, more overdoses and deaths related to heroin use. Plus, learn more about a new statewide women's conference and an initiative to provide a high-quality early childhood music education to every four-year-old in Duval County. All of that and more are ahead, but first this hour, record numbers of viewers are tuning into debates to see what the candidates have to say, and maybe not even realizing how much they're judging the way those candidates say it. Mark Vickers is a certified speaking coach whose day job is helping business executives communicate more effectively. He's putting those skills to use this morning to help us evaluate the presidential candidates' speaking styles. Mark, thanks for being here.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here this morning.
We're so glad to have you. Is there something in particular you've noticed about a candidate's speaking style? You can join the conversation at 549-2937 or tweet me at Karen Fagans. And just a reminder, we're focusing on communication styles and not policy in this conversation. So, Mark, when we talk about this election, I think we have to start talking about Donald Trump, especially since we're talking speaking styles. So what is it that makes his style so appealing to so many people?
I think the key with Donald Trump is that he's able to connect emotionally to the electorate. There was an article written about a week ago that talked about and complained about how Donald Trump spoke with the vocabulary of a fourth grader. Well, when we're coaching business executives, we're always telling them to simplify their message, because a simplified message, and this does not mean dumbing it down, it means making it really easy to listen to and understand very, very quickly. And if you watch Trump, he is a master at the very short sentences, very short statements.
We do have some audio of Donald Trump at the latest debate. Let's take a listen.
I am going to bring jobs back to the United States like nobody else can. We're going to fix our very depleted military. We're going to take care of our vets. We're going to strengthen our borders. And you're going to be very, very proud of this country in just a few years if I'm elected president.
When I hear Donald Trump and you talk about simplifying sentences, I think about the difference between writing for a newspaper and writing for broadcast. We're taught to write very short, direct sentences, and that's what I hear when he speaks.
Exactly. And that was a perfect sound clip, because it was, I don't know what there were, four or five statements that he made there. Each one was very simple, very pointed, very direct. It didn't take a lot of thought to understand exactly what he was saying. And that's a huge part of what's making him so effective.
We're going to get to some of the other candidates soon. You can join the conversation at 549-2937. We do want to point out that Mark is actually Canadian, a Canadian living here in Jacksonville. Completely nonpartisan and no skin in the game in this election whatsoever, right?
Exactly. And it makes it a whole lot easier to analyze the communication skills when I'm not buying into one side or the other of the conversation. It's just truly evaluating their effectiveness.
All right. We're already getting some calls. Let's go to Jim on the West Side. Good morning, Jim. What are your comments about the candidates' speaking styles?
I wanted to answer your question that just as you were talking about Donald Trump a moment ago, I think that of all of the candidates that we have, Donald Trump has the most effective speaking style for the job at hand, which is campaigning and stumping. Donald Trump's greatest, most superlative quality about him is his brashness. That's really all that he has, is brashness. And it just so happens that brashness is typically enough to manipulate enough people to go your way. And so he has a following because he has brashness. Ben Carson is a fantastic guy with all the integrity in the world, but nobody's going to follow that speaking style. He should be a surgeon, and he was, and he's a very wonderful man. But Donald Trump has the brashness, and people want brashness.
All right. Thank you very much for that call, Jim. What do you think about what Jim has to say? Is there, I've heard criticism also of Donald Trump that if you really listen to what he's saying, sometimes there's not a lot of there. he can talk for a long time and not really answer a question.
You're right. And I like Jim's point. That brashness that Trump has, it connects to people. It pushes emotional buttons. One of the things that salespeople have known forever is that people buy based on emotion and then they justify based on logic. Well, Trump is a master at pushing those emotional buttons, the crassness, the one-liners that really connect with people. And part of it is that Trump is willing to say the things that many people have thought, but very few politicians will ever say. There's things that Trump has said that many of us have said over our own kitchen table, talking about the state of the economy.
Let's move on to another candidate, Ted Cruz. He appears to me to be a pretty polished public speaker. Let's take a listen to Ted Cruz at the latest debate.
Well, Megan, you know, at the end of the day, for the folks at home, this is not about the insults back and forth between the candidates. This is not about what attacks we can throw at each other. This is the people at home who are struggling. Through 7 years of Barack Obama, this is the single moms who are working 2 and 3 jobs, 28, 29 hours a week, because their hours have been forcibly reduced because of Obamacare.
All right, so what I hear there is a little bit of a preacher.
Yes, I would agree with that. And the question is, what was the point that Cruz was trying to make in that little segment? When you compare that to what Trump says, at the end of each sentence, we knew exactly what Trump was saying. With Cruz, and Cruz is not the only one out of the remaining candidates, sometimes it's hard to find the core message. Now, in terms of his actual presentation, very polished, very smooth. And I think both he and Marco Rubio have that professional debater type quality, that lawyer formal training thing.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily connect well with people, but there may be more message than what Trump has in his words.
Cruz, of course, is a Harvard law grad, and I've seen mm-hmm. some analysts compare him, at least in the complexity of his speech, to President Obama.
Mm-hmm. And the complexity is where the problem comes in. Because if you want to connect to the vast majority of the people, you want that message to be so crystal clear that there's no room for misinterpretation. And when you hear it as a soundbite, people go, oh, I know exactly what he's talking about.
We are speaking with Mark Vickers, a professional speech coach. And you can join the conversation this morning by calling 549-2937. Bob in Orange Park is on the line. Bob, what are your comments this morning?
What I wanted to say more than anything else was that when I look at Trump and I look at his lower lip coming out and I look at his hands, I'm thinking of Benito Mussolini. I've seen the old film clips. That's what his style is reminiscent of to me. And I'll take my answer off. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. And there's been an awful lot of talk about hands in this this presidential debate.
There has been way too much talk about hands, and it's probably the question I've been asked most over the last couple of days is, what do you make of this? As far as I'm concerned, whatever night that debate was, Friday night, whenever it was, I think both Marco Rubio and Donald Trump should have been sent to the corner for a 5-minute timeout, or the FCC pulled their ability to be on broadcast television for a couple of days. We wouldn't accept that kind of behavior in most businesses in this country, yet we seem to accept it from our political candidates. It's not appropriate as a communication style. It's not effective. It doesn't help us make a decision. It just serves no purpose whatsoever.
Let's get to Bob's other point about candidates sounding dictatorial.
This is a tough one to answer, because people who are very effective at motivating large numbers of people and creating the movement, as they've called it in the Trump campaign, they can sound very dictatorial because they have that presence. They have that charisma that has a lot of people following them. Communication is one of those things. It's a great power, and Trump has it. But with great power comes great responsibility. The question is, how is that power really going to be used?
We'll continue working our way through the Republican candidates and then get to the Democrats in just a moment. Let's go to Marco Rubio now. He talks a lot about change, opportunity, and the future. We have a clip from the debate the other night.
I believe the 21st century holds the potential to be the greatest era in the history of the United States if we get this election right and if we act now. If we do what needs to be done, we can leave our children as the freest and most prosperous Americans that have ever lived, and the 21st century can be the greatest era in the amazing story of America.
All right, what are your thoughts on Marco Rubio?
I think that clip in particular was a very good example of Marco Rubio at his best, where he's issuing a very clear message and a very clear vision. Marco Rubio is an interesting character because he's kind of got elements of a number of different communication styles. And when he sticks to what he does best, which is what we just heard, I think he could be very effective. The problem is he has other times where he becomes too much the polished politician. And then last week we saw he got down in the trenches with Donald Trump, which didn't play well.
Mm-hmm.
I think if Rubio really maintained his authentic self in all of his talks and really connected at the personal level, I think he'd be standing much better at this point.
Well, a lack of authenticity is often the argument against Rubio.
Exactly. And you know, for as much as Trump is 100% authentic, he's always the same guy. If you listen to Rubio in a town hall versus the debate versus an interview, you do hear three different styles of communication. And I think that hurts him. People don't realize there's a disconnect, but they realize something's just not quite right. Something's not connecting.
So you're saying they don't know who's going to show up that evening.
Exactly. And that brings into question, you know, the trust, the relatability. Who is this person really, you know, that I'm listening to?
You can join the conversation this morning at 549-2937. What are your thoughts on the candidates' speaking styles? We're here with Mark Vickers, a certified speaking coach. Also joining the conversation this morning, Bill in Mandarin. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. You know, I remember that old saying, better keep my mouth closed and thought a fool than to open it and eliminate all doubt. But I was wondering, what can we make of, in a refined sense, the message we like to listen to with enthusiasm? Oftentimes we kind of forget the audience sometimes makes the speaker great.
When we're listening, and this is the challenge within the presidential debates and the whole process that we're going through right now, we do tend to get wrapped up in our party, what candidate we like. In Marco Rubio's case, because we're in Florida, there's people that are vying for him because he's from Florida. So we get wrapped up in that. And I think what happens is sometimes we stop really listening to what's being said. We are so much behind one person or one ideology that we really start almost tuning out. And I don't like the saying, but I can't think of a better way to do it, drinking the Kool-Aid from any candidate. I would challenge everyone, as we've got more debates coming up over the next week, to take a step back and just really listen to what's being said and how that candidate makes you feel about what they're saying.
Well, that's an interesting point, because shouldn't people be listening more to what candidates are saying than how they're saying it?
They should be, yes. And again, back to that long-term phrase of people buy based on emotion, justify based on logic. This is the time when we need to be using that logic and listening to what is the real message. What are the policy positions? What does it really mean? Who do we really trust? Who do we think can relate to us as people in this country versus all the dramatic elements that they're building into the process right now?
All right, let's go to John Kasich. This is a candidate who hasn't been getting as much press. Let's listen to his speaking style, and then we'll talk about him a little bit.
The fact of the matter is I'm running for president because I worked hard to fix this country when I was in Washington as the chairman of the budget committee, where we had some of the most significant job growth after we balanced the budget. We had wages going up. It was very successful in Ohio. Our wages grow faster than the national average. We're up over 400,000 jobs. We paid down, back in the old days, they paid down $500 trillion of the national debt. It's a formula that works.
Okay, so here's a guy I think many would argue has the substance, but even in that 30-second clip, I found myself tuning out a little bit.
Yes. I got to say, I feel bad for John Kasich, because I think when I take a look at how we monitor and measure communication effectiveness, from a substance and from a knowledge perspective, on the Republican side, he probably is about the strongest in the bunch in terms of being able to articulate. So not commenting on his actual experience, but how he articulates that knowledge and background. The problem is there's not a lot of excitement around Kasich. If you were to put Kasich and Trump together in one set of styles, and you'd have the flair and you'd have the substance, that would be an unstoppable combination.
Do you think if he just had a little more energy that it would help?
I think it's energy, but it's also knowing when to inject yourself into the fray. As you mentioned, John Kasich has gotten very little airtime during the debates and outside of the debates because he's not making the conversation about him, which you could argue that it shouldn't be about him. But when you're competing against a Donald Trump who's been so effective at having the spotlight on him all the time, and for example, when in history has a political candidate ever been able to say the words, "I don't like fighting with the Pope"? Never has that type of thing happened. But Trump is so good at keeping himself in the limelight, he's able to say those things. Guys like John Kasich, it doesn't matter how good their substance is, because again, people buy based on the emotion first, and then they justify with the content or the logic later.
We have a tweet from Terry. Says, Mark mentions being clear and concise, but vague answers in the speeches is a problem that I am seeing.
So here's the challenge. In the speeches, they don't have the time to go into a lot of detail. So what we coach business people on is to give us a 3-point plan. Just real quick, if I want to deal with the national debt, my key 3 things are A, B, C. To deal with healthcare, I'm going to do 1, 2, 3. So we at least have some idea of what they're trying to do. We hear a lot about, I want to do this and I want to do that. And the comment's very valid. There's no how behind it. People want to know, how are you going to make these things happen? And there's a severe deficiency of it right now.
How much of this is a result of our TV soundbite culture?
I think a huge part of it is. And what's interesting, I heard it last night, I'm not sure which commentator it was on CNN, said that moving forward, the town hall forum is much more effective than the debate forum. Because in the town hall, it's a one-on-one question and answer with the candidate and someone from the audience. And even though I'm sure a lot of the questions are staged and planned out, at least we're able to hear a real discussion about an issue. I think it's a better forum than what we're seeing the debates degrade into.
Again, you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 549-2937 or tweeting me at Karen Fagans. Our guest today is Mark Vickers, a certified speaking coach, and we're talking about the candidates' speaking styles. We're going to go now to Duran on the West Side. Good morning, Duran.
Good morning, and it's actually Doran.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's quite all right. Quite all right. It's a typical, it's a typical mistake. But I wanted to just quickly ask your guest about accents. I know we're talking about speaking style, but I thought about accents, and I wondered if your guest would contrast Jimmy Carter, who had a very distinct Southern accent, and George Bush, George W. Bush, who also had a rather Southern drawl. To me, Carter was more accepted, at least not his policies necessarily, but his speaking was better accepted, while Bush was castigated as being a hick. So I wonder what's the difference there. I'd love to hear what your guest has to say about that.
Thank you very much for that comment.
That is an incredibly interesting question. I had never thought about that combination of Carter and Bush. So much of it comes down to the content. And what we would need to do is go back and look at what those candidates or what those presidents, past presidents, were saying at that point in time. The key with accents is, and I always tell people, don't try to hide your accent because it comes back to being authentic. You need to be who you are. But I also say, use all of the gifts that you're given. So if you have an accent and you're from a South, own that, embrace that, but understand how to leverage that if you're up in the New York, New Jersey area, which is a totally different speaking style and a totally different accent. But ultimately, it does come down to your ability to create a connection with the other person and say something that they actually care about.
Maybe some people wondered with George W. Bush, as a man who was raised really in the Northeast, if that Southern accent was authentic.
It could be. And it's, again, without going back and actually looking at some of the video of that time to do an assessment, it's really tough to say. But accents, especially Southern accents in the North, can be viewed as a lot of different negative things by mm-hmm. different people.
It brings up the issue of code switching, and when candidates move around campaigning all over the country, there's some criticism of you know, a Southern accent suddenly appearing when you're in Arkansas, or and it does happen. Is that pandering or is that human nature?
Yes, both. I was on the public speaking tour for years, and when we would move from state to state, you would pick up certain elements of the speech from that area. But again, coming back to authenticity, people who are watching that are going to know, mm-hmm. and they're going to feel it. And they may not intellectually go, oh, there's a problem here. But subconsciously, they're picking up a disconnect between who you really are and who they're seeing in front of them. And that feeds into a lack of trust.
Let's move into some of the Democratic candidates. Let's start with Hillary Clinton.
Well, I'm running for president to do my very best to knock down every barrier that stands in the way of America really realizing its potential and every American having a chance to live up to his or her God-given potential. We have a lot of work to do. We have economic barriers. That's why I've laid out plans for more good jobs with rising incomes.
All right, your thoughts on Hillary Clinton.
I think years of experience and being in the political arena has given her the depth of substance and content, but also the experience in how to use her voice more effectively. The biggest thing I notice with Hillary Clinton is there are times, especially when she's on stage behind a podium, that she reaches a very high level of energy in her voice and then she gets stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
We want vocal variety when we're listening to people. It re-engages us, and it's part of that credibility, and it's less of a stump speech and more of a conversation.
Is that what leads, you think, to some of the criticism we've heard of her as a screamer? I mean, that has been denounced as sexist, but it is a criticism you hear of Hillary Clinton quite often.
It is. What's interesting is when I'm coaching business people, we hear that phrase of a screamer more about women speakers than mm-hmm. we do about men, and it has to do with the pitch of the voice. A man can keep that same high level, and Rubio and Cruz do it as well. They keep that very high level, but because the tone of voice is lower than Hillary Clinton says, for example, it doesn't reach that screaming level, even though from a decibel level, it's probably exactly the same. But it's something, if I was coaching her, I'd say, you know, when you're at the front of the stage, behind that podium, give us more vocal variety. That's going to help people engage more effectively.
All right, now let's take a listen to Bernie Sanders.
Middle-class families are struggling. Cities and towns are struggling in order to provide basic services. Among many other things, we need to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, our water systems, our wastewater plants, our roads, and our bridges. The wealthiest country in the history of the world has got to get its priorities right, take care of the people, no more tax breaks for billionaires.
It sounds a little bit like he's losing his voice there. But what do you hear when you listen to Bernie Sanders?
It's interesting when I listen to Bernie Sanders, there's a couple of things. First of all, Bernie Sanders needs to add a little bit more material to his repertoire. Almost every sentence ends with billionaires or Wall Street. We get it. We understand that's his position. We need to hear a little bit more, because I think what's starting to happen is people are tuning out that part of his message because we've heard it so often.
Oh, so it's almost taking what you suggest about keeping everything, you know, having a narrow message, but taking it to an extreme where it's too narrow.
Because people just stop listening. Because you can listen to any sound clip from Bernie Sanders, and I was waiting to hear on that one which one came up, if it was billionaire or Wall Street, because you know that every sentence is going to end that way. So that's part of the challenge that I think Bernie Sanders has in front of them. The other challenge, and this is where we really take communication skills to the whole overall perspective, the look, the sound, the attitude, and everything else. I can't help, when I listen to a sound clip like that, if you close your eyes and just listen to it, think of Back to the Future and Doc Emmett Brown. See the correlation?
Yes, I hadn't thought about that, but Sean Birch is going to be very glad that you made a Back to the Future reference. Our producer loves that movie.
So when you listen to Bernie Sanders, especially when he gets wound up, when he's in the town hall setting, I think he can be very engaging, and whether you like his message or not, he's pretty effective at articulating it. But when he gets wound up like he has in the last 4 or 5 days, he starts to sound like Doc Emmett Brown. He's maybe just crazy enough to be onto something really good, or he may just be a little bit crazy. You're never really sure. And I think that's going to hurt him, because Hillary Clinton's doing a good job of staying relatively stable, and we're seeing Bernie Sanders go a little bit off the rails from a communication perspective. Forget about policy, just how he's approaching her in the debates. He's going into interesting territory.
So out of the six candidates we've listened to that remain in this race, who do you think is the most effective communicator?
It's going to depend on how you gauge most effective. For purposes of the campaign and the primary season, there's no doubt that Donald Trump is pushing the emotional buttons and getting people motivated and engaged and rallied around his campaign. If you want to take a look at substance and having a core message, somewhere between John Kasich and Hillary Clinton. If you think about a debate between Kasich and Clinton, there could be some good, meaty conversation there, as long as it didn't go off the rails.
Absolutely. So what do you think we can learn, since you normally work with business executives, if you were using this as a masterclass and we sat here and listened to all of the candidates, what would you suggest to someone as a takeaway?
As a takeaway, I want people really watching what it is that Trump does that connects with people, and how he so quickly can get a person engaged in his vision, even if they don't know what the vision is. If we're talking to salespeople, for example, we want them to connect very, very quickly to whoever they're speaking with. At the same time, I want them to look at the other candidates in terms of what works and doesn't work in terms of relaying complex messages. And how are those messages being simplified in a way that anybody could understand very quickly? There's a lot we can learn by just watching from a non-engaged perspective.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever have business people who say, I don't want to be anything like a politician? It's kind of a dirty word, right?
It is. And while we may not want to be like a politician, I don't think there's anything wrong with taking the things that the politicians do that are highly effective and incorporating them into what we do as business people. Because every business person is out there speaking and selling all day long. And those speaking skills and being able to refine those and get them to the point where you're powerful and effective every time you communicate, from a business perspective, that's important.
All right. Mark Vickers is a certified speaking coach. He lives here in Jacksonville. You have a book coming out soon?
We do. We have a new book. The title's still under discussion, but it's basically The Sales Jungle. It's how to use communication skills to increase sales, retention, and customer satisfaction.
All right. Well, thank you for using those skills to help us evaluate the candidates. It was an entertaining half hour.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day. Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, a first-of-its-kind conference for women in Florida and the push to expose local preschoolers to music education. But up next, a spike in heroin use is leading to more arrests and deaths on the First Coast, and the problem could get even worse. We'll talk to the director of the Duval County Health Department right after this.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
Oil and gas prices are still low. So too, though, are oil worker wages.
We have found cases where workers were not even paid the minimum wage because they're working so many hours. So the idea that they're being highly compensated, in some cases, they're not.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Wage theft in the oil patch, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Al Letson, and I'm hosting a brand new show here on WJCT, and I'm bringing some friends with me.
Everything, with Al Letson as the host and Willie Evans Jr. as the DJ. Well, he's not really a DJ, but he does something.
Every week, we'll be bringing you some stories, some laughs, and something to think about. Sundays at 2 and Wednesdays at 1. Earthang. It's a new show, because we going to do everything we want.
Earthang. The opposite of nothing.
On the next Fresh Air, a recovering heroin addict who now works with addicts and is part of the harm reduction movement. Tracy Helton Mitchell was one of the five young addicts profiled in the 1999 documentary Black Tar Heroin. Now 18 years sober, she's written a memoir about her addiction and recovery that includes her insights into today's heroin epidemic. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Karen Fagans, in for Melissa Ross. And we didn't plan it that way, but that promo was quite appropriate because we are about to talk about heroin. Arrests related to heroin use are up, and the number of overdoses have more than doubled in 1 year, according to Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams. He, along with the sheriffs of Clay and Nassau counties, held a news conference last week to bring attention to what they're calling an epidemic. Our guest, Dr. Kelly Wells, is the director of the Florida Department of Health in Duval County. She was a part of that news conference as well. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
In 2014, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office says 17 people died in heroin-related deaths. Last year, that number was up to 45. So this is a pretty significant increase. What do you think is the cause for the spike in heroin use and the deaths related to heroin?
Well, I think there's a direct correlation in the discontinuation of prescription opioid overuse and abuse. A lot of folks in the community and across the nation who have addiction issues related to prescription opiates are now choosing heroin as their drug of choice.
So a crackdown on pill mills and the availability of those drugs has made heroin where people are turning.
Well, and I would add to that one sort of additional step. Prior to that, you had overprescribing that was occurring as physicians across the country were really responding to a mandate that had occurred in the late 90s to really focus on pain relief. You know, in the late 90s, pain became the fifth vital sign. And a lot of how physicians, hospitals were measured, you know, had to do with, you know, how well we controlled pain. And that led, you know, without appropriate oversight controls, that led to some folks who were addicted to opioid received by prescription. And that has kind of gotten us to the point where we have now. As we've stepped in to correct it by sort of cracking down on pill mills, we have not adequately addressed the fact that there were a number of folks who had significant addictions to these drugs.
So we're still seeing the fallout of that. What is heroin and how do people commonly use it?
Heroin is a derivative of morphine. It's an opioid analgesic, so painkiller, but it causes euphoria as well. And most folks are using it by injecting it.
And we've heard about it all across the country. I've seen 60 Minutes talk about an increase in heroin. How bad is the abuse in our community, and what are we seeing on the First Coast?
Well, it is something we've been tracking. As the numbers have been increasing across the nation, I think every Department of Health across the country has begun to prepare to respond to this as it hits their neighborhood, so to speak. And from a public health standpoint, we track drug use, so, you know, calls made to poison control, overdoses, absolutely, and then other, you know, sort of addictive behavior. So you see an increase in, you know, crime rates and that sort of thing, and all of those things are trending up in our area. Also in the region, we're seeing an increase in the number of newborns that are exposed during pregnancy to opiates, which results in what's called neonatal abstinence syndrome. You know, so a child who's born addicted and immediately after birth is experiencing withdrawal symptoms as a result of that.
Now, I know across the country there's been an increase in young people using heroin. Is that also happening here on the First Coast?
Well, I think if you translate the demographics of those who were using prescription opiates, it's not necessarily the very young. It tends to be, you know, young adults where we see it most commonly. The concern is, however, that the earlier folks are experimenting with these particular drugs, the more likely they are to progress to heroin while they're still very, very young.
Okay. So now that we have identified this as an issue for our community, what can we do as a community to help?
So that's the key. I think we have to be very, very informed in terms of understanding that any response to this, in order to be successful, has to be multifactorial. And what I mean by that is, you know, there are some preventive measures that need to be put in place. So we want to decrease the chances of first use. We want to continue to modify and improve prescription practices for physicians. We want to help young people change behaviors and build coping strategies and that sort of thing so that their use of substances is really mitigated before it begins. But there are folks who are currently addicted. There are people today who are at risk of dying from an overdose, and in some cases with their first use of heroin, which is really alarming. 120 people, you know, die daily in the United States related to this. So we've got to have some point of care interventions as well. You know, so there are some medications that can be put in the hands of first responders and family members to reverse the effects of an overdose.
Are you talking about naloxone?
Correct. That's the sort of thing that will save a life right at the point of care.
What are the laws in Florida about the use of naloxone at this point?
Florida has actually done very well in terms of naloxone availability, and there is the opportunity for a family member or a loved one of someone who is a known addict to actually obtain this to have on hand in case they witness an overdose. So that is available to folks in our state, and it's not the case in all states across the country, so that's something that we should be proud of. I think the next step is to ensure that it's in the hands of first responders. And there are some national initiatives to, you know, control the price point of that particular product so to be sure that everyone can have access to it so that we can really ensure that the use of it is implemented rather across the board.
Okay. So if someone listening to this right now knows someone who is dealing with a heroin addiction, or if they themselves are, what resources are available to help them?
So there are a number of resources. Yeah, I think one of the most difficult things, knowing what addiction is. You know, so the definition of addiction is to be dependent upon a drug to the point that you actually will continue in behaviors that you know cause harm to yourself in order to obtain that particular drug. So that's different than dependence, which is I withdraw when I stop use, right?
Okay.
So an addiction is I know it's destructive, I know it's hurting me, I know I'm not taking care of the things I need to take care of, but my disease actually prevents me from being able to change behavior. It must be very difficult to watch someone you love and care deeply about experience that and continue to do things that are, you know, detrimental to their well-being in order to obtain a drug. So, number one, you know, someone who is watching that or who themselves is dealing with that could certainly reach out to any one of our, you know, community partners that are well-versed and experts in substance abuse. You know, River Region, Gateway come to mind, but there are many in our community. So help for addiction is one part of that. I think I would also advise people to become informed about the other resources, you know, see their physician about a prescription for naloxone, for instance. Become familiar with what the rules and the procedures are in your local community in terms of having access to that and how to respond. Become knowledgeable about, you know, support groups and substance abuse groups and prevention organizations that are in your community. There are a number of initiatives that are in place already that I think folks aren't really, really aware of. And there's some hotline, you know, you can call 1-800-662-HELP, which is a hotline for caregivers as well as those who are struggling with addiction themselves to begin to gather information about how to become clean and sober.
All right, Dr. Wells, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kelly Wells is the director of the Florida Department of Health in Duval County. Later in the program, we'll talk with a man who is bringing the sound of music to Jacksonville preschools. But up next, pay equity and gender equality on boards and in the executive ranks. Just a few of the issues that will be discussed at an upcoming statewide women's conference. We'll tell you all about it when we return. This is First Coast Connect.
James Corden has broken records for late night TV by buckling in pop stars and taking a drive.
You want to see the joy in people, and you want to see the person that always dreamt of being a star, you know? Isn't she
wonderful? Sing along with Stevie Wonder and Adele. It's Carpool Karaoke later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Sam Brody gets why so many people are moving to the Houston metro area.
You move to this area and you're like, cool, I have a water view.
This is a great place to be.
Plus, good jobs, great schools. But there's a catch.
The last thing you think about is 20 feet of water coming up here.
On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, EU leaders meet at a summit in Brussels while more than 10,000 migrants are trapped in Greece at closed borders. The ongoing refugee crisis and new questions about the future of Europe.
At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. I'm Karen Fagans. Registration is now open for a new statewide conference that will raise awareness of timely issues for women, both at work and at home, such as leadership, mentorship, and social change. The Women's Conference of Florida will be held in May in Tampa. Arlene DiBenigno is president and CEO of the conference, and she joins us by phone this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Karen. Thank you so much for having me on First Coast Connect this morning, especially on such an important day as International Women's Day.
Oh, we're glad to have you here. That was appropriate scheduling. Why did you why did you feel there's a need in Florida for a conference like this that focuses on professional women?
Well, I think supporting and encouraging professional women to pursue their greatest potential has been a passion of mine for more than 9 years, actually. Ever since I was involved with the California Women's Conference, I've been focused on creating an event of the same magnitude that will positively influence women in our state and provide them with the empowerment and the necessary resources for both personal and professional development. We have so many talented women in the state, and I think it's important to give them a platform to come together and not only learn from one another, but also find ways that they can work together.
So what can people expect at this conference? Who are some of the speakers that you're bringing in, and what are some of the events planned?
Well, we have a wonderful slew of national speakers. We have Jill Abramson, who's an author, a journalist, and she's the former executive editor of the New York Times. And I think with Jill, the important conversation, obviously, is that there was such a public ouster when she was removed from her position, but also the conversation of pay equity. She was making less than the man that held the position before her, and also made less than the man who holds the position now. So I think she definitely has much to say as it pertains to that conversation. We have Jean Chotsky, who's the NBC financial journalist. She's an author and a motivational speaker. And I think from her perspective, it's helping women understand financial investments, not only as it pertains to their business, but also to their personal finances and making sure that they're in charge and in control of that aspect of their life. We have Anna Maria Chavez, who is a wonderful speaker. She's the president and CEO of the Girl Scouts of America, and she is coming in to talk about leadership and what we as women can do to frame the path for, you know, the next generation who is so important and needs our help. And then we have Kellyanne Conway, who's the president and CEO of polling company Women Trend, and she focuses on issues that are important for women, and we'll talk about some of those patterns of behavior and how they impact our society. And then Lori Greiner, who's an inventor and entrepreneur and very well known as a Shark Tank panelist, and she really comes in to talk about how everyone told her that she could not achieve what she's achieved today, and how women are sometimes we unfortunately listen to that no voice versus the yes voice. So I think we'll have a wonderful slew of national speakers. We're continuing to add to that roster as we get closer to the conference.
That sounds like a great lineup. It's a 2-day event starting on May 19th yes. in Tampa. Registration is now open for the event?
Yes, it definitely is. And if anyone who's interested can visit our website, which is www.womensconferenceofflorida.com find more information as it pertains to the conference and registering. And for us, it's really about creating a movement here in Florida, given that Florida women represent only 11.8% of board seats, Karen, in public companies. We want to change that. And so what better way than providing a 2-day conference to encourage professional women of all ages to combine their singular voices into one strong collective voice so that we can start changing that pattern of behavior, you know, across the board.
Well, thank you so much, Arlene DiBenigno, for being with us this morning. Good luck in your first year of the conference.
Thank you, Karen. It's greatly appreciated. And we hope maybe to see you there as well.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Arlene DiBenigno is president and CEO of the Women's Conference of Florida, which will be held in May in Tampa. Our next guest wants to provide a high-quality early childhood music education to every 4-year-old in Duval County while in preschool through his organization, Guiding Success. Richard Cuff is executive director of the League of Florida Orchestras. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this.
So tell me a little bit about Guiding Success and how it got started.
Well, I must thank my daughter. She would walk around the house at 2 years old pretending to play the violin. We didn't know where she got it from, but she always did it. On her 4th birthday, I said, "What do you want for your 5th? She says, "To play the violin." Duh. So on her 5th birthday, we surprised her at this stranger's house. She blew out the candle, and my wife said, "What did you wish for?" She said, "A violin." Duh. So I said, "Well, let me see if the wish fairy has, you know, answered your wish." I go get the violin and give it to her. So on the way home, she's on cloud 999, right? And she says, "Dad, you think we can get a violin for Ayana and Dinah and Tina?" And she just started naming all the kids. I said, "No, don't you dare tell those kids that I'm going to get them a violin." And at that very moment, the entrepreneur in me said, "Wait a minute. This can be done." And about a $3,000 investment and some little bit of time, a couple years later, we have the only program that teaches 3- and 4-year-olds to play violin in preschool.
Yeah, you're doing it. You have a VPK program where these very small children are learning to play violin.
Yes, exactly. Now, the pathway to get there started with the work that I did with the Jacksonville Symphony. I was a consultant to the symphony and helped to develop the Jumpstart Strings program there. But the Jumpstart Strings program specializes at the elementary level, about 3rd or 4th grade. What I know is that there are children in certain communities that by the time they get to the 2nd or 3rd grade, they've seen more of life than the average human being. And their path is pretty well set to not go that way. So I realized we had to go even earlier. And a good friend of mine, Andy Bruck, who's the violinist with the Jacksonville Symphony, partnered with me and went into All About Kids. And the owner, Joanne Walker, who's been great, she has funded this program 100%. She opened up the doors and literally created the All About Kids VPK Music Academy for us to grow, and we're now in our 6th year.
6 years. So you talked a little bit about why it's important to get kids involved at this very early age. How does that success at an early age translate 6 years later? What are you seeing with the first kids from the program?
Well, let's go back to the poster child, my daughter. She's now a freshman at Stetson University on a violin scholarship majoring in music education. She's on a path to her master's at Carnegie Mellon and a PhD at Juilliard. We have students at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. We've got students at La Villa School of the Arts, and we've got students in elementary level, and we are now looking to expand the program. So what it does is it's a simple donation, or the donation of time and energy creates an investment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been proven that for every dollar that we invest in children at 3 years old, it's a 7 times return by the time they're 18. So that's what we're beginning to see. These children are not only are they articulate and focused, but they're disciplined, and the family unit around that child and the music is so well put together. The problems like a 300,000 miles on your car, like me, driving to music lessons and all those other things are a byproduct. But that's family time, the time mm-hmm. you're riding in the car, the time you're sitting there with the going through practice, and even the tears as they're getting frustrated, and you're helping them to learn how to deal with life.
Yeah, it's life lessons.
Exactly. And one of the funniest things is that my 4-year-old class, if a child comes in crying, I don't have to say it anymore. They say it. There's no crying in music. Crying only makes it hard to see.
Oh, that's so great. That's so great. We did an event here at WJCT in January, and we're going to air the program in March. Later this month, about the barriers and access to children of color. Yes. In arts education. Is that something you think about?
I think about it all the time. I see it. The most disheartening thing is culturally, the thought is those kids over there are missing something. I've heard the mayor and other politicians say there's a culture of crime. And it hurts my heart because I know that there can no more be a culture of crime than there can be a candle that, when lit, fills the room with darkness. A culture of crime doesn't exist. What happens is you blow out the candle of culture, whatever that dominant culture is, and it moves to the other side of town. And then suddenly what comes in is darkness. And that darkness, our kids have to grow. What we need to do is bring culture back to the community, turn the light on, and watch what happens. The kids will thrive.
So what are your plans for the future for this organization?
Every year we have an event on the last Saturday in March that coincides with Earth Hour, but it's the launch of our CASEY campaign, Cultural Awareness Community Image Enhancement, and the words say the mission: to enhance the image of our community by raising the awareness of our culture. We are launching on that day our 21-day Give It Forward, Guiding Angel Give It Forward campaign. Individuals will make donations on behalf of their friends. So I will give you a wonderful donation and say, Karen, I've made a donation on your behalf, and I present to you your angel wings.
Oh, nice. And that's how it works.
Yes, I've now made a donation on your behalf.
You really
simply
did?
Have to, yes.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. You simply wear the pin during the 21-day campaign starting on the 26th of March, and someone will ask you, why are you wearing the pin? It's because Richard made a donation on my behalf.
And then you pay it forward.
And I challenge you to pay it forward.
All right. So where can people find more information about what you're doing and about the campaign?
Log on to guidingsuccess.org. And you'll also be able to like our Facebook page at Guiding Success.
All right. Richard Cuff, thank you for all you're doing. It's a great program.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. That's our program. Thank you very much to all of our guests and our callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on Diane Rehm's show, new questions about the future of Europe as leaders discuss the refugee crisis. That's coming up next. I'm Karen Fagans, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. Melissa Ross will be back tomorrow morning at 9. Have a great day.
Support for First Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.